Good afternoon. So, last time we were talking about improvements beyond the sort of simple inode-based file system model we started with. And one of these was to deal with having metadata for files really far apart from the actual data for the files. And we had this problem in FAT because no matter how clever we were about choosing where directories and files had their data, the file allocation table was at the beginning of the disk, which would have to be far away from some files' data and some directories' data. And we had the same kind of problem with our inode-based file systems, where the inodes were in one place on the disk, the data was in another. These would end up being far apart. So our solution to that was to divide the disk up into what we called block groups. And each block group would have their own set of data blocks, inodes, and free block maps and other metadata. And we try to keep related files and their metadata together. So the way the Berkeley Fast File System chose to do this is it tried to put all the things in one directory within a block group. So the directory entry would be in the same area of the disk as the data for the file. And as the inode for the file and the inode for the directory would be in the same place. And this would mean that hopefully we'd have less seeking and rotational latency when accessing any file and its related data. Now, the way FFS implemented this was a preference, not a requirement. So if we couldn't manage to fit all the directory in one block group, like maybe it was too big, maybe we made some mistakes about what we put in that block group earlier. We didn't need to, somehow rearrange things to make this not the case anymore. We could just say, okay, we have some things that are not in this block group because we could still have pointers to things in other block groups. And the way we managed that is that we just divided up our block and inode indices between the block groups. So when we looked at a directory entry, we wouldn't actually, explicitly check, yes, it's in the same block group or not. We just say, it's that item number, what block group is that? And usually it would end up being the same one we read the directory entry from, but that is not required. So block groups gave us some locality for files, but we had some issues where we were using a lot of space for storing information about files that maybe wasn't necessary. And there were two kinds of wasted space we were concerned about. So one was with small files. We had to choose a block size, or in fact, a cluster size, that was sort of the minimum unit of a file we would store. And this was kind of not a very happy choice for us. If we made the block size, really large, this would simplify our bookkeeping of blocks in general and be an improvement in performance. But this meant when we had a file that was smaller than a block, that we'd end up allocating a block for it. That's all we could bookkeep about what's used, and we'd have to use only a little piece of it. The rest of it, no one could use. So a solution that FFS came up for this is that they divided up the blocks into pieces, but they only used those pieces for small files. For normal files, they do bookkeeping on the order of blocks, so they wouldn't have the extra overhead of just making the block size smaller. Now, since FFS, we've become more concerned about large files, and even when we make the block size, pretty generous, we end up discovering that, well, large files, we're still not going to be very happy. We think of like a gigabyte file, we're going to want to deal with, files which are only a couple kilobytes well, and that means in the scheme with direct pointers and indirect pointers that we were talking about for inode-based file systems, or with a linked list of cluster numbers, we have, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of block numbers or cluster numbers that we have to look up, store, and tell the disk about when we're reading or writing. And that can get pretty inefficient for a large file, both in terms of performance and in extra stuff we're, you know, putting on the disk, so space we're using. And our solution for that was that we would store extents, especially for large files, where we'd, instead of having a pointer to a single block or cluster, we'd say, it starts at this block, goes to this one, and ideally, we'd allocate a small number of extents for a large file, ideally one, maybe we can't manage one, but still a small number, and this would be a lot easier as far as reading the file than dealing with a lot of block pointers. Now, for both fragments and extents, we're paying a cost to have this extra flexibility, and that cost mostly comes when we're writing and creating files. That to deal with fragments, we need to track not just blocks, but parts of blocks for figuring out what blocks are free and allocating blocks. For extents, we need to be much more careful about allocating contiguous ranges of blocks. So we have to use a lot more complicated way of finding a place to put a file if we want extents to work out for us. So, any questions about these topics from last time before I start talking about and finishing up redo log? Okay, so our second big topic last time was about reliability. And we were solving one particular reliability problem. I mentioned that there are others, like what if the disk just fails? And this was performing multiple updates at once, where we wanted to be the case that if we were interrupted, like if we lost power or we had a crash, that we'd still have consistency. That we don't want it to be the case that because I lost power at some point, suddenly there's some stuff on the disk I can't access and I can't free up. And we found out that the way we were doing updates to our disk, we wanted to modify multiple things kind of at the same time, but we can't physically do that with a disk. So we need to restructure our file system so we can effectively do multiple operations at once. And the way we had to do this involved a lock. So our procedure for doing any update with redo logging is we record our intention that we wanted to do this set of updates in a log, and then we record a message in that log saying we committed to that intention. And a key way I like thinking about redo logging is that once we've recorded this committing to that intention, the operation is done. And you might say, but we've only written down what we intended to do. From the application's perspective, our job as the implementer of the file system is going to be to say, is that at this point, we're gonna make sure no matter what happens, the operation is done. No exceptions ever. And so we could tell the application honestly, yes, I've created that file, it's gonna be there no matter what happens. Now, to actually make this happen, we can't just have the information in the log because that would mean we'd be scanning a log for everything, and that's not how our file system works. It's not a very effective way of looking up files, not with the mechanisms we've discussed. You could imagine a file system designed to work that way, and there are some, but it's not what we typically use or have talked about previously in this class. So we have to get stuff out of the log and actually onto the quote-unquote real parts of the file system. So after we commit to doing the operation, we need to actually do it. And we need to be really sure it gets done. So the way we're going to do that is on a crash, we're going to check the log, and we're going to redo what was intended. And when we redo it, I say redo, we may or may not be redoing it. So maybe the crash happened just after we recorded the commit. Maybe it happened much later. Depending on that, we might be repeating operations or not. Doesn't matter. You know, we're just ensuring that they get done somehow. And eventually, we want to clear out space in the log. We don't want to keep this around forever. you know, we run out of space. So we, once an operation is fully complete, once we've actually done it, we can clear out space in the log, and that's not going to be a problem. So I'm going to finish up talking about some little things with redo logging, but we've gone over most of it. So questions about redo logging. So one thing that's an important detail about how we implement redo logging is because we might be repeating operations that are in our log, we need to be careful about how we write down things to do in our log. So we need them to be what's called idempotent, meaning that if we do them twice, it's the same as doing them once. So for example, inodes have on XP6's file system have a link count, the number of directory entries that point to them. And we want our log entries to be something that, you know, keeps track of this correctly. So it's going to be something like set the link count to 4, not increment it. Because we can't increment it twice and expect the same result as doing it once. Or if we want to overwrite, you know, an inode, that's fine. If we want to allocate a new inode, if we do that twice, that's going to be a problem. So when we write our log entries, we're always going to write these things where if we do it multiple times, no problem. Which means that, you know, if we're appending to a file, we're not going to write append to a file. We're going to write, you know, data block with index where the append happens. So if we do that twice, it doesn't cause an issue. An important thing about things. So, yeah, that's just something about how we implement them. So, to give a concrete example, in XV6 log entries are just replace sector X with that, with this contents. That's what XV6 writes in this log, is just put this in sector X. So, if we do that twice, Sector X has the same contents, it's not a problem. But if we try to be more clever, we might run into trouble. Okay, so that's idempotency. So, mentioned redo logging, I kind of gave you the idea that it's applied to file systems. So there's a terminology thing. So, commonly, when there are file systems that use redo logging, you'll see the term journaling file systems. And the journal is another name for the log. So you'll commonly see file systems referred to as journaling. That means they do redo logging. Okay. So let's talk about exercise to go over redo logging. First, I have some setup. So let's say we're appending 100 kilobytes. And let's say we're going to do this in one transaction. So it's going to happen all at once or not at all. We're going to talk about what that means for the redo logging, but we have a file system that uses redo logging. First question is, what do we need to modify to do this operation on our inode-based file system? I'll give you like a minute or minute and a half. Think about this. Which things are modified to append to this file now that we use redo logging? And, you know, and let's just be clear, we'll say eventually. So I mentioned that maybe we can complete the operation from the application's perspective before we actually fit change everything, but we're going to say, you know, what has to be modified eventually as part of completing this operation. you know, at some point. Close the poll in 15 seconds. Okay, so we have this that the free block needs to be modified. Yes, so we need new data blocks. And we need to mark them as not free anymore. We need data blocks for the file. Yes, where does the data go? We need to modify an indirect block. Yes, because, you know, only about 12 direct pointers. Those first 12K kilobytes. So the first 12 kilobytes don't use indirect pointers of some sort. And because we're beyond that and we're modifying, adding new blocks, we have to be modifying the indirect blocks. The blocks, this is the blocks of pointers, is what I mean. The data blocks for the directory. And so this one was a bit tricky. Data blocks for the directory, I believe, do not need to be modified because remember the directory entry here is name inode number. So this would be true in FAT. So in FAT, the directory entry stores more information, but in these inode-based file systems, we decided to put all the file information except the name in the inode, so we don't need to modify the directory entry to change the size or the modification time or things like that. The inode for the file, I think definitely, because this has the size, the modification time, and possibly other relevant information. Inode for the directory, I think, doesn't need to be modified. And the log needs to, because we want to ensure this operation happens all at once, so we're going to need to do that two-step process. Okay. Right, where we write our intention to the log first. So questions about the answers I got here, which I think most people agree with. First, so question is, how big is the log? What happens if you try to write a file first? So that's a question that varies between file systems. But, you know, if this was too big, then the file system would have to split this up into more than one transaction. And we'll talk in a bit that some file systems cheat to use less space in the log. I really mean cheat. And we'll talk about that in a bit. But if this was too big, basically the file system would like split it up into an append half of it or something like that to two transactions and use the log separately for each. Does that answer your question? Okay. So other questions? So let's do, Okay. So let's do a second part of this, which is, let's say, hi. Let's say, I want to, yes, I want, okay. Let's say, I'm so, no, I'm missing an option. Well, kind of profile. What happens after, so let's say we write all the log entries, we change the free block map, we change the indirect blocks for the file. What stuff do we have to do as part of restarting? Yeah. So we reboot, crash happened, we didn't do all the changes. So what are we going to end up doing when we reboot? I'll give another 30 seconds or so. Okay. So, hi. So we have. Okay, so remember so key thing to realize here is we don't have the bookkeeping to say that the free block map plus indirect block changes happened. And so because of that, we're going to repeat those operations. Now, technically, we could probably do something where we like read the free block map and check whether we need to write it. So maybe we could avoid the extra write that way, but probably not worth it if we have to read it anyways to do that. But basically, we're going to have to do the equivalent of these operations again, because we won't have remembered that we did them. All we remember is what's in the log. We aren't writing other places besides, like, if we actually read where we'd have to overwrite. Now, we also need to go do the rest of the operation. So we need to write the actual data. We need to write the inode and so on. We didn't write the data blocks for the directory or the inode for the directory in the original operation. There's no reason we're going to have to do it when we're trying to finish the operation after some crash. Now, the log is a tricky part. So eventually, we need to free space. So we're going to write for that. You know, whether that's really part of this operation or not, I think is ambiguous, so I understand answers either way. So questions about sort of my answer here. Okay, so let's talk about briefly about some realities of redo logging. So one thing is that redo logging seems horribly inefficient because we're writing everything twice. But it's not actually quite so bad in practice. And one reason is that we can write the entire log sequentially. So even though we're writing more stuff, we're writing in a way which is very, very friendly for hard drives. Hard drives love writing sequentially because there's no seek time, no rotational latency. We just keep writing what's under the head. And it's also pretty good for SSDs because we're all doing new locations. And we can like do all the updates in any order. no matter where they are on the disk. And because I gave you the idea that once we write the log, we're done as far as the application's concerned, you know, as far as like the time from when I write a file to when it's on the disk, that's lower because it's on the disk when it's in the log. So this is often actually better for performance, but not unconditionally. Like, we still are writing more. So it's better for performance when, you know, we would normally be writing to lots of places on the disk. Now we're writing to one, that can be a lot better. It might not be so much better for performance if we're writing a lot of data where, you know, it doesn't really matter where we're writing on the disk. Writing twice as much is still going to be a huge cost if there's so much to write. And so because of this, some journaling file systems cheat. So some journaling file systems don't use redo logging for everything. So some only use it for metadata operations, meaning like inodes, block pointers, directory entries, etc., and not the actual data and files. And that means that they have made a decision that the data in your files, if that's sometimes inconsistent after a crash, well, that's too bad. But it helps performance because that's like stuff where you do a lot of duplicate writing of a large amount of data. That's where you might actually hurt performance from redo logging. But the metadata operations are all little tiny writes where redo logging will probably help your performance. So some file systems work this way or work this way by default. Even though, based on my description of what redo logging is for and the consistency ideas, you might say, really? Shouldn't we just, like, don't I care about my data more? That's not the decision they made. Okay, so that's my final word on redo logging. So any questions before I move on to our next topic, which is about distributed systems? So now we're going to gear up and go to a completely different topic of making multiple machines work together to perform a single task. I'm talking about this very generally, and we're going to call this idea a distributed system. So you have multiple machines each, and they're going to cooperate and somehow run effectively one application. And you know, you've kind of seen this. So like a website you connect to that has not one server running it, but a whole bunch, that's a distributed system. And when we're talking about distributed systems, so there's sort of two sort of extremes of how we typically see distributed systems organized. There might be some in-between points, but we'll talk about these two extremes. So one is something we'll call a client-server model. So we have our different machines, which I'm representing as boxes here. And in the client-server model, we designate one or a very small number of those machines as the server. And we have a whole bunch of clients that talk to the server. Versus the other extreme is the peer-to-peer model, where every machine can do anything and we have some way they communicate with each other. And we're mostly going to be looking at this model because it's what's most common. And obviously, like, these are like two kind of extremes. And client server, I have this sort of strict hierarchy with like one server. With peer-to-peer, I have this sort of chaos. Anything could happen. And obviously we could find some points in between. We're not going to talk about them much given how much time we have. So in our client-server model, which is going to be what's going to dominate, we have clients and servers and what distinguishes them. So a client is, you can think of it as being a machine that's sometimes on. So a client, it sends requests to servers, and the only reason it communicates to servers is because it sent a request to them. And this sometimes on, you know, can't always be contacted. And we'll be more restrictive than that. Only contacted because the server replies to it. So in this model, the server only knows how to contact clients because the clients have contacted them first and said, hey, tell me something. And our example here is the client's asking for a web page and the server is replying with it. And the server can contact the client because the client asked for that. And our server is going to be something that's always on. So clients should always be able to ask the server for things. And its purpose is to respond to requests from the clients. So it never actually initiates contact with a client. The client is always the one who does that. Now, the client-server model might seem insufficiently flexible for doing a lot of things that might happen in the real world. And you might say, like, why are we like using this very simple model? But it actually is like pretty ubiquitous, but often in sort of a layered sense. So often we'll have kind of multiple layers of clients and servers. So a common way a website will be run is we'll have our client, this is, you know, your browser, we'll talk to a web server, but that web server won't do all the work itself. It will talk to something you might call an application server. And so the web server is a server for your web browser and a client for this application server. And in turn, the application server could be a client for an ad server or a database server. So we have these kind of layers where in this layering, you know, some machines are playing the role of server for one part of the system and client for another. But it's still all a client-server idea because, you know, the application server never gets, doesn't know how to contact the web server directly, the web server doesn't know how to contact the web clients directly, and so on. So there still really are servers and clients in the sense of how that client-server model works. We've just sort of composed multiple copies of the client-server model to build our overall system. And this is like super common in like big websites. So to give a really concrete example, here's a 2015 flowchart of how Wikipedia structures their website. I'll give a zoomed in version. So this represents where your web browser is. It goes to one set of servers that contact another set of servers that contact a third set of servers that contact two other servers. And we have this giant layering, and each of these lines basically represents a sort of client-server relationship. So we can see we have, it's all client-server, but we have sort of many layers, and in many of these cases, you know, this here represents, you know, many duplicated servers, in order to handle a lot of requests. Most of these boxes probably represent that. But it's still this client-server idea. So questions about this model? Okay. So this is versus peer-to-peer. So in peer-to-peer, sort of something about that extreme is that there's typically no always-on server. And, you know, what's the advantage of this if we have an always-on server? Well, you know, there's some bottleneck that, you know, that could be a problem. And with peer-to-peer, our hope is that because we don't have more important machines that we can better handle, you know, more things happening. And in peer-to-peer, like, any machine, like, could play an equal role. So that seems useful. And also, because we don't have this always-on notion, we can more probably change the set of machines over time. But, obviously, because we have a less rigid system, the bookkeeping gets a lot more complicated. And maybe actually taking advantage of the flexibility is pretty hard. So, little exercise about our client-server model. So we talked about client-server versus peer-to-peer model. Let's say, what is true, advantage of client-server over sort of the more general peer-to-peer idea. And I note that some of these answers are a bit subjective. I'll close the poll in 15 seconds. So some of these answers are a little subjective. So we'll start with A. So I think A is probably easier with peer-to-peer because no machine is very important. But, with client-server, the solution is multiple servers. So the common way that people do this with client server is they duplicate the server and somehow extend that model so the client knows to contact a server and not just any server. But with the peer-to-peer model, we've kind of baked in this resistance to any machine failing because all the machines are kind of equal and we know we can contact sort of all the machines. So it should be easier to handle that. Now, for B, I think this is probably easier with the server model, with server, client server. As long as the offline machines are clients. So if we can make sure the machines that are offline are clients, it's free in the client-server model because we never contact a client, which is offline, because the only reason we ever talk to a client is because it contacted a server. In the peer-to-peer model, if a majority of the machines, most of the machines are offline, like that seems to mean that most of our functionality is not available. And as for C, I would think that this is probably better in the client server because this is where we put the servers, this is where we put the clients, and these clients have less work to do. So that's going to be a good fit for when we have these low performance machines, we can make them clients, and because they have less to do, we're not going to be paying the price of them being low performance. Whereas with the peer-to-peer model, we kind of start off with trying to have them be equally important, and that would get us into trouble because we noticed that we have all these low performance machines. So questions about sort of my analysis of sort of these trade-offs. Okay, so something that probably seems like a distraction I like to talk about is, why would we make systems distributed anyways? And this is a good question because we're going to talk about like dealing with things going wrong in distributed systems and find out that we've made things a whole lot more complicated. So why is that worth doing? And there's different reasons this happens in practice. So one is that we might have multiple people who own different machines who want to work together. Like, you know, my bank and my credit card company want to talk to each other. They don't want to run each other's, you know, databases and machines. So we're going to end up with the distributed system in order to make that happen. Also, we can think of this as something where we want to delegate responsibility. If I don't want to, you know, manage, you know, some part of my service, like I don't want to deal with storing my backups, I might delegate that to someone else. That someone else is running the safe place where my backups are stored. I end up with a distributed system because I have my stuff, and they're the part of the responsibility I've offloaded onto them. So this is sort of the, you know, multiple machine owners reasons. And that's a common reason. Note that this is not a technical reason so much as a social reason why we want multiple machines involved. So there's also more technical reasons why we might do this and why we might have a distributed system even if we own all the machines together. And one big reason is that it might be, you know, cheaper for the functionality we get. That if I combine many cheap machines, maybe that can do the job of a really expensive machine. So for example, back in the days of the dot-com boom, it used to be common to buy a really expensive server, like $500,000 or $1 million to run your dot-com website. And you know, that's pretty expensive. And if that's not good enough, you're gonna buy the $2 million version. You know, that's not great. And what people have leaned towards instead is combining cheap machines. So with cheap machines, you can get sort of economies of scale that you're buying machines that are, you know, not special purpose for running large websites. You aren't going to pay a premium because of that. And you can easily add incrementally to it. You can just buy a few extra machines and add on to it rather than doing what's sometimes called a forklift upgrade where you take replace one giant machine with an even more giant machine. Another big reason why people try to use distributed systems is that you could build in redundancy, and we're gonna have an assignment that's kind of about this, where if one machine fails, you could still have the system work. So if we structure things correctly, which is gonna take some work, then we can, you know, keep our website up even though we're running on hard drives where 10% of them fail every year. You know, and if that caused our, you know, Google to go down, that would be really bad. But we can structure things so that any one of those failing isn't a problem because we're using multiple machines. So questions about these reasons to have a distributed system? Okay, so now that we've talked about sort of why we distribute things and our basic models for organizing a distributed system, let's talk about how we communicate. That's going to be our main topic for today. How do we actually communicate in a distributed system? I'm going to start with sort of a very abstract model, and we're going to then go to like something that like actually has code. So our abstract model is going to be what I'll call a mailbox abstraction. So each machine has a mailbox of messages that they're waiting for, and there's a send operation which put something in another machine's mailbox. So our send operation is send hello to B's mailbox that's run from machine A. And conceptually, machine A is connected to the network somehow, Wi-Fi, Ethernet, whatever. It sends out a message for B's mailbox, and the network figures out how to deliver it to machine B. It stashes it in the mailbox, and a program can get it out with a receive operation. Okay, so this is sort of the type of functionality our networks provide. So, very simple model. We have this send operation, and this is what's, so this is the program operation here. And this is what sent on network is just, this is for B. So the user address, it's hello. So you can think of this kind of like an envelope which says B, and inside the envelope is our letter that says hello, which is where we get the mailbox model idea from. Now, if you think about our client-server model, you'll realize that there's kind of a disconnect here, because I have a way for a client to send a request to a server, but how does the server respond? There's nothing in here that lets me know who it's from. Well, our solution for this is going to be that we're going to build on top of this something more flexible, where we can reply, and also where we can send things that need to be split across multiple messages. So how do we handle replying? Well, we're going to use the same kind of idea you'd use with mail, and that's just we're going to write a return address here. Well, the equivalent of that. So we're going to send a message with a return address. So we send a return address. We also might want to have multiple messages, you know, together. Well, we're going to track related messages in some way. How are we going to do that? Add data to what's sent to link messages together. And we're going to put this functionality into another more complicated abstraction that's much more useful for programs, known as a connection. And if you take a networking course, you'll spend a lot of time working on how do you implement this connection abstraction. We're mostly going to talk about how do you use it and deal with things that are, you know, above that level. So a connection is a two-way channel for messages. And you might think this looks kind of like how a pipe works on one machine, but across multiple machines, and that's going to be a very helpful insight. But we have two extra operations. So we have a connect operation and an accept operation. And this is something which is sort of very naturally adapted to the client-server model. So machine A is our client, and in order to send a request to a server, it first makes a connection to it, and the server accepts that connection. And to implement this with our mailbox model, this connect operation is going to turn into a message on the network that says, hey, someone wants a connection. The accept operation is going to turn into a message saying, yes, we're going to make your connection. And then later on, we're going to have a send and receive operation. But rather than just going to our mailbox and who knows where it comes from, they're going to be tied to a particular connection we previously made, either by creating it with connect or accepting it. And on the network, the way we can implement this is that we'll tag our messages with information about the connection they're for. So questions about this connection idea? So these connections, if you think of it, they kind of look like two directional pipes. We can write from one application on machine A and read from another machine B, and we could do the same. And in POSIX, in fact, they have the exact same API, that you get a file descriptor that represents one of these connections, and you can use read and write as your send and receive operations. And we'll talk about what that looks like in a bit. And this is implemented on the internet over mailbox style communication. So if you take networking, you'll learn all about how that works and so on. But first, we have a few missing pieces for actually using these connections and understanding how we would use them. In my example, I said B, and we have the machine identified as A, but that's not going to be good enough. And there's sort of two reasons for that. So first of all, you know, I need some way of specifying machines, and, you know, just naming them all A, B, and C, that's not going to work on the internet. We need something a bit more flexible. Also, we have multiple programs on a machine. And who is it for? Who gets the connection? Like, I can SSH into a machine that's running a web server. So that's two different things. I don't want to accidentally connect to the web server instead of SSH or vice versa. How do we make that happen? We'll talk about solving both of these problems. We'll start off with this question of how do we specify the machine? And to talk about this, we're going to talk about a general idea of names versus addresses that comes up a lot in operating systems in general. So a name is what I'll call a logical identifier. And you can think of this as, you know, maybe this is for humans. So for example, we're going to have machines identified by what we'll call host names, which you've probably seen some of these before. We also have names like file names. So here's a file name, but that's not how it's identified internally. We have variables, which have a name. And we have sort of services which have a name. And we're going to translate these into addresses. So with file names, we've seen this, that we have a file name. This gets translated into an inode number because that's what we actually need to read the file. And we also need information more than the inode number about what disk it's on. So when I was checking on my laptop, this is the address information, this is, you know, how to actually find that file versus the name I gave to it. And we have the same thing for host names, for machine names. So this identify www.virginia.edu identifies a machine, but that's not, you know, a way to actually locate it. To actually locate it, we're going to have this address, which is going to look like this, or something like this, to actually locate those machines. We'll talk about this article. And it's the same kind of idea how we have a named variable versus an address of that variable that lets us locate it, like via the page tables, or we have a named program on a machine, so the web server, versus what we'll actually send over the network to identify the web server, how we find it, you know, locate it directly, which is going to be what we'll call a port number. So first, let's talk about machine names. So typically, on the internet, we use something called the domain name system to find machine names. So we have these names, like virginia.edu, which need to map to addresses. So you might ask, well, how does this work? Like, we can't possibly give everyone a map of all the machines. It used to be the case that that's actually how this worked, you know, that we actually distributed to absolutely everyone on the internet a list of all the machines on the internet. But that only worked for a couple years. After that, we need something where we're going to have to ask someone for the name, what this machine is. And the question might be, how do we find that? And this uses a distributed system called the domain name system. So this is a distributed system that stores machine names to address mappings. And the way it works is when I connect to a network, I get the address of a server. So this is going to be constructed using the client-server model. And I get the address of a server when I connect to a network of my ISP's DNS server. And I, as the client, ask it for, hey, how do I get to cs.virginia.edu? And the ISP server acts as a client to some other servers. So this is sort of that composed client-server model. So, and it's hierarchical. So it's going to go first with this bottom part, you know, figure out where to go there. And it's going to ask, you know, something called a root DNS server, which has information for everything, except it doesn't store all that because that would be way too big. So instead, it's going to say, okay, well, you know, I don't know where this server is, but I know who might know. So it's going to say, you know, I don't know anything about that server directly, but I know who knows stuff about .edu. And it's going to say, try the .edu server. And then my ISP's DNS server is going to go, okay, let's try ask the .edu server. And the .edu server is going to say, well, I don't know who that is, but I know who knows about virginia.edu. Why don't you ask them? We're going to ask them. And then they're going to tell us, oh, I don't know who knows about cs.virginia.edu. I don't know about cs.virginia.edu, but I know who does. Why don't you ask them? And eventually, my ISP's DNS server will find who's actually responsible for this. Now, you might say, gosh, this looks like it makes it looking up this name very slow. How do we deal with that? Well, our main answer is that, yes, we're going to get an answer, but we'll cache the answers we get along the way. And we won't just cache this. We'll cache, like, the answer we got from the root DNS server. We'll remember, oh, everything on EDU, the root server doesn't know about it. I should always ask this EDU directly next time. And once in a while, we'll check for an updated version. So this is sort of our high-level tutorial on DNS. You can see that this is sort of a distributed system. We've divided up the responsibility, and it's distributed both because we can't do all this on one machine and because we have sort of separation of who's responsible for different parts of the names. And we kind of embedded that in the design of this system. So questions about DNS? So now that we know how to get these addresses, let's talk about what they are. So IPv4 addresses are 32-bit numbers. They're just written in this form with dots, which is just 8-bit values written as decimals separated by dots. And organizations get blocks of these addresses. Now, IPv4 addresses, not all of them actually work on the internet. So there's some special addresses which are for local use only. So there's one block of addresses which always are the machine we're on. There's several sets of addresses which are for local networks where you can't use them on the internet. And you might sometimes see these assigned to your machine, and what's happening is something called network address translation, where rather than using that address on the internet, there's something which translates it to another address when you talk to a server and then translates it back so you can pretend to be using a different address. And this is only done because we don't have enough IPv4 addresses for everyone because we made a mistake and 32 bits is too little. But this is just to let you know that, hey, these aren't really used on the internet. We're not going to talk about the details of network address translation because that's a topic for a networking course. So that's IPv4 addresses. But the key idea, it's a number. Organizations get a block of public addresses. There's some private ones which don't go on the real internet. Some filtering happens to replace them with something else. There's also IPv6 addresses. So as I said, we can't give everyone an IPv4 address. And many years ago, people realized that this was bad and tried to fix it. And we've very slowly been trying to upgrade to larger addresses with IP version 6. which has 128-bit numbers, and we write them out using hexadecimal separated by colons. Kind of, you can see the mapping here. And the idea is we have so many of these, we can give you a ton of addresses and we won't run out. So this is great. Unfortunately, a lot of networks don't support this yet. For example, the CS Virginia.edu network. But that's the goal for the future, so we, you know, don't have to run out of addresses. And like with IPv4, there's some special addresses which are local only, but most of the addresses you actually can use on the real internet. Now, we have these addresses, and I said they're numbers. Organizations get ranges of these numbers. And why do we give them ranges? Because of how we're going to use these addresses. I said they locate where the server is. And you might say, I send a message addressed to an address. How does it get there? And the solution is that we're going to have routers. And the routers are going to have what we'll call a routing table. And they'll have just ranges of these numbers, and they'll know where to send it. And because we keep ranges going to the same place, like virginia.edu gets the same range, we can keep the size of this table not too big. So on the internet, I've heard that the size of these tables at big ISPs with the largest sizes is, you know, maybe not more than 300,000 entries, which is a lot, but manageable. And that's because we can group all the related machines together. We don't need an entry for every single machine. Okay. So questions about routing. I know I'm kind of rushing through this. Routing and addresses. So we assign these addresses, which are numbers. We have a mapping from names to addresses. And we can use the ranges of addresses to efficiently take a packet that's addressed, a message that's addressed to someone, and send it to the right place without having like to know how to get to everyone individually. So I know how to specify the machine. How about we deal with what about multiple programs on one machine? How do we deal with that? So our solution is going to be something called port numbers. So we have an address that identifies the machine, and we'll add an extra number identifying the port number. And you can think of this as kind of analogous to like a PO box at like UVA, like it identifies where exactly the message goes once it gets to the right machine. And internet mostly uses 16-bit port numbers, and basically what we do is we assign particular numbers to common services. So SSH is assigned 22, for example, HTTPS is assigned 443, and so on. We might also allocate these on demand, and one reason we'll do that is when a client connects to a server, the server needs to send stuff back to the right client. How does it do that? We give the client a port number for its return address. The question is, how many networks would a typical, question back going back to routers, how many networks would a typical router have in its routing table? It depends on how many networks it's connected to. So like a lot of routers like are typically connected to a very small number of networks, but at big ISPs, there'll be some routers which are, you know, connected to tens of other networks, or maybe more. It just depends on like how much stuff is the router connected to. So note that when I say network one, it might be the case that network one goes to another network, but the router will still say, send it to network one, just to make that clear. Okay, so that's port numbers. So now we know about port numbers, you know, we're gonna, you know, eventually we're gonna think about protocols. So I know about like making connections, but how do I use connections? And to use connections, we need to have an agreement on what we're going to send on those connections and what that means. And we've used a bunch of protocols normally. And we'll talk first about what is a protocol. So a protocol is a way we're going to like use things like connections. It's an agreement on how to communicate, includes both you know, what's the format of our messages and what do those mean? So for example, let's give a human example. When you pick up a phone, there's a particular way you expect to communicate. So like you dial a phone number, you wait for it to ring. You know, when you answer a phone, our convention is you say hello, you know, and then you reply with what's the name. You know, we have this sort of convention of how we start. We have a convention of how we finish. And that's an example of a protocol. We have this sort of implied agreement about how we communicate. When we're using connections, we're going to have a much more explicit agreement about how we communicate and what messages mean. And an example of why we need this is when your web browser talks to a web server, it needs a way to specify, you know, what's it asking for, how does it expect it back, and that's all going to be part of this protocol, which is both going to include, like, what format does it send the name of the file it wants to download from the web server, and what does that mean when it sends that. And there's lots of protocols out there, and there's actually layers of protocols. So there's a protocol for specifying when I send something to the network, how do I include the IP address in that, right? What's the format of that? What does it mean when it's there? They're called IP for Internet Protocol. There's a protocol for building connections on top of that. How do I specify I'm connecting or accepting? How do I say that these two things are in the same connection? So there's a protocol called TCP for that. And on top of that, we build the protocol called HTTP, which is like how the web browser connects to a web server. That's, you know, it uses the connections, but we still need to figure out how do I agree what file I'm asking for, what you send back or the file's not there, and so on. So we have these layers of agreements on what things mean, and this is how we build our distributed systems, because we have to have all our machines agree on how they'll communicate. And there's tons of protocols out there that, you know, at each of these different layers. So for example, there's a whole bunch of protocols that you commonly use built on top of TCP. So TLS adds encryption, HTTPS, which you've probably seen in URLs, is HTTP on top of TLS, SSH is built on top of TCP. If you've used SFTP or SCP, that's built on top of SSH, which is built on top of TCP, and so on. So you have these layers of agreements on how to communicate, and that's how we are going to build our distributed system. Now, so I talked about sort of abstractly how we use connections. And I'm going to finish up by talking about sort of what our actual interface from an OS point of view is going to be for using connections. And in POSIX, we're going to get connections via what we'll call sockets, which are a file descriptor that represents a connection, as far as we're concerned. So as I mentioned, they're going to act like a bidirectional pipe. So once we set them up, we're going to be able to write and to one from one end and read from the other, and write from the other and read from either end. So we have this sort of, they act like a pipe, but in both directions. So that's how we end up using them. But the question is, what's this setup operation look like? So let's talk about what the setup operation looks like. And we're going to have different setup operations for the client and the server. So on the server, we're first going to create a server socket, which is not associated with a connection, whose sole purpose is to get connection, but it doesn't get associated with a connection. Our client is going to create a socket with this call to a socket call that it's going to somehow connect to the server. So both of them are going to call the same socket function. The server is going to create a server socket by choosing an address and saying it wants to listen for connections. but it's not actually going to read or write to the server socket. So instead, the client is going to run a special connect operation specifying the same address the server use this bind call to set, and that address is, this is a host name, so this includes the port number, IP plus port number. So both the machine and the particular program. And the server is going to call accept on this server socket, and that's how it actually gets a connection. So the accept is going to make a, you know, second FD on the server, and that's going to be associated with our connection. That's where we're going to be able to read or write in both directions. So questions about sort of our high-level view of how the setup works. So we have this server socket, which only exists to accept, and the client calls connect to make its the file descriptor it got be associated with the server. The server calls accept to get a new file descriptor for each client. And those file descriptors are our bidirectional pipe. Question is, what does bind do? The bind sets this address that the server expects to the client to connect to. Does that answer your question? The question is, can SSFD produce multiple FDs? Yes. So this accept can be called multiple times. And each time it will give you a new file descriptor. Other questions? What is the difference between listen and accept? Listen is just a, says, tells OS, I am not connecting. So bind sets an address, but it doesn't actually tell the OS whether you want to connect or not. Listen says, I'm not going to connect, and it lets the OS know that you're planning on accepting instead. Does that answer your question? Okay. So this is sort of the API, and the way this works on the network is that once you set up these, you know, the file descriptors associated with the connection, this is going to be identified with what's called a 5-tuple on the network. So we're going to have our protocol, our local address and port number, and a remote address and port number. And this is what the OS is going to track. OS tracks this for all sockets. And that's how we're actually going to use the mailbox model to implement this, is that we'll send out, hey, here's something for, you know, TCP coming from this IP address, this port number, going to this IP address and this port number. And that's how it works. And the bind function sets our IP address and port number. And if you don't call it, the system chooses one for you. So for example, here, the client called connect without calling bind. To make this connection work, we need to have a place for the server to send the stuff back to the client. So the OS is going to choose an IP address and port number for you to make that happen. And you can actually look up all the sockets that exist on your system. So here I'm printing out on my desktop, well, here are what sockets existed at the time, their state and their local IP address and port number, and their remote IP address and port number. And this is actually what's tracked to implement those file descriptors. So given this interface, the way we're going to implement our clients and servers, you know, is going to look like this. So on the server side, we're going to have this create in configure server socket step. That, you know, we're going to create a server socket, we're going to bind it to set the address, and start listening for connections, tell the OS, hey, I don't want to connect to anything, I want to get connections. And our client is going to create a client socket, and we're going to associate these because the client is going to call connect with the same address we bound to, and we're going to call accept to get a particular file descriptor for that client. Once we do that, we communicate with the client. And in this example, I'm saying hypothetically the client and server take turns and the client goes first. This is not necessarily what you have to do. You have flexibility. It depends on how you've chosen to have the client and server communicate. In our example here, when they're done, the client and the server both close the socket, and in this case, the server moves on to the next connection. You might think, what if I want to handle multiple clients at a time? Well, you know, our solution, one solution for that is going to be to use threads, and we'll look at that, you know, when we start next time. So I think I am out of time and probably don't want to use any more time than I'm already using. Okay, so any questions about this overall flow before I move on? Before I finish up for today, rather. So.